After me.
Okay, the civil justice meeting will come to order. And Representative Jackson moves the minutes of February 22nd, since she was upset she didn't get to do it last week. All in favor, say aye. All opposed, no. Carries. Okay, let me explain what we're doing this morning. It's landlord-tenant day here, and there's a package that came in this year from Legal Aid and other groups that represent tenants. And it's an overall package, and then it was broken down into four bills. And so I authored one, Representative Clark authored one, Representative Champion authored one, and Representative Hayden offered one. The intent all along was that we'd work with the representatives from the Landlords Association and others to try and work out what could be agreed on and that we could go forward with. So what we had agreed was that we would have this hearing, get input from everybody, present the bills, each side, get input, and then lay over all of the bills. They're working on them right now. Both sides are working very well this year. And I think we're going to get an agreement in the end. And so both sides have now agreed the way we'll proceed this morning is we're going to have a brief summary of the general issues and then a couple of witnesses. Then I will present my bill, and then we'll proceed with the bills in order. And then at the end, that will be from Legal Aid side. And then at the end, the Multi-Housing Association will present their views on the differences that they see. And that's how we're going to do, and everybody's agreed to it. So the first testifier will be Mike Dowell from Homeline, and he's going to kind of explain the overall package of bills and how we're going to work on that together. And one question I have just before he just walked in the room, Steve Johnson, Steve, are you going to testify or? Okay. Mike, why don't you go ahead and present the overall picture?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Michael Dahl, and I'm the Public Policy Director with Homeline. Homeline is a statewide nonprofit organization that offers free legal advice to tenants so that they can solve their own rental housing problems. We provide advice regardless of income, and staff and volunteers explain to tenants the laws and describe legal options available to them. We track all of our contacts by zip code and issue area. We've been doing so for the last 17 years. In 2009, we handled 11,000 calls, and 25% of those calls came from outside the metro area. Homeline always clarifies for renters and lets them the law for renters and lets them know if there's a fix for their situation. Sometimes the law is not on the tenant's side, and we let them know this. But in a significant number of cases, Homeline believes that greater tenant protections are necessary to make state law fairer. And sometimes we believe better clarity in the law would help tenants and landlords alike. Homeline combined our ideas with those of Legal Services Advocacy Project, as Legal Services have been amassing for years issues that could assist their clients. And the result is what you see before you today, the Minnesota Tenant Bill of Rights. I'd like to provide a context for why we think the time is ripe for the legislature to consider additional tenant protections, and then after my comments, we'll follow the order that that you outlined. We believe that the time is right now, first of all, because tenant-landlord law has seen relatively few changes for the last 20 years. If the ideas that we're presenting seem large in volume, it's only because there's a dire need. I think last year you saw a number of issues addressed regarding foreclosures and renters, but that issue sort of was in isolation compared to a real examination of tenant-landlord law. Second, I'm sure you've all heard about 10,000 times from every witness that comes up here that we don't envy your job. We know there's a big budget deficit. We come to you with a set of proposals that won't cost the state a dime. In fact, The ideas that we present, we think, will save renters, landlords, and the state a ton of cash. We believe, third, that responsible tenants, good landlords, sound buildings, and fair rules lead to strong communities, and we believe that the Tenant Bill of Rights will result in better maintained properties, clearer rules for legal disputes, warmer apartments, reduced court costs, along with many other benefits. And before I close, I want to note that we know that multi-housing has some concerns with our proposal, and as you noted, we have met with them twice to try to come to some sort of common ground, and we will continue meeting. However, I would like to sort of address some of the major concerns that we've heard from them that sort of give you our take on some of the concerns that we've been hearing. First, nearly every idea that you see before you is law in many other states. Or city ordinances in many cities across Minnesota. For one of the proposals, Minnesota simply falls behind what 42 other states do to protect tenants in the rental market. Second, to listen to what we've heard from multi-housing, our proposal for a statewide heat ban is a statewide heat code is unworkable. However, 40 cities in Minnesota with population over 5,000 and a number of states already have something fairly close to what we're asking for. Third, we have a proposal to provide renters with a receipt if they pay their rent in cash or money order. You're likely going to hear about how this will lead to administrative burdens and need for additional staff. We're asking for a receipt. This is practiced in a lot of areas in the market, and we just don't understand the resistance. Fourth, we think that legal disputes between a landlord and a tenant should only appear on a tenant's record after a judge has ruled in the case. Right now, something appears on a record and stays on the record unless a tenant proactively asks that it be removed. And so we ask that be one of the changes. We believe that the ideas in these bills are reasonable, that they will save money on many fronts, and that they will make Minnesota law better. Not only that, everything we propose, good landlords, most landlords do already. We just want to raise the bar and make sure that we're providing proper homes for tenants in Minnesota. And now I'll turn it over just to a couple of testifiers to give context for why we came up with these ideas.
So, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Holder.
Can you tell me how your organization is funded?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Holder, we have a number of communities. Most of our funding actually comes in through private foundations. We have a number of small grants from local communities to provide the free legal advice to tenants, and that pays for the hotline portion of our work that we offer to tenants and advise them on their legal rights.
Mr. Chair, if I may, what are your two top private foundations that fund you?
I can certainly get the answer for that for you.
Mr. Chair, do you work for them?
I do, but Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I'm not the person that handles the finances, but I can have that answer for you before the hearing's done.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, is grants the only thing you get from some local communities? Do you get any state or federal money?
Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, we have no state or federal money for our work.
Okay, can we go ahead? Would you state your name?
Good morning, Chairman Mallory. My name is Peggy Larkin, and I'm a rental tenant in a Section 8 community in Maple Grove.
Go ahead.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here in support of the Tenants' Bill of Rights and to tell you why this bill is important to my family. I'm a single mother supporting two children on my own on a meager income. I've lived in the same rental unit for the past 6 years, but it's so much more than a rental unit to me. It's a home. I've built up roots in the community over the years. I work in the community. My children attend school there. My daughter plays basketball there. I vote there. I'm a consumer in the community. I attend church and volunteer there. This bill ensures that my housing will remain safe and stable, and that I can stay in this community, that my children can stay at the same school, that they can be productive members of this community, and that we can be near work opportunities. My family and neighbors are in a vulnerable position because the playing field is not level between tenants and landlords. I'd like to share with you my story about my own home, the disrepair and mismanagement I've encountered, and how it's affected me. Several times since I've lived in my rental unit over the past 6 years, my landlord has come to me and told me that I owed $3,000 or greater in back pay and rent. Each time I've had to go back to my bank from all the way to 2006 and get copies of checks and prove up every time that I've paid my rent, that I'm doing what I'm supposed to, that I'm there. And it's their mismanagement of their books that is causing these problems. And that's a huge ordeal for me. It's very scary for me to possibly face eviction when I know I've paid my rent. And it would help me if I had a receipt. If they provided me with a receipt, then I could easily prove up these rent payments to them. In addition, I'd like to talk to you about some of the disrepair in my unit, and I've passed out a picture, and it's up on the document viewer. This is a hole that was in my ceiling in my bathroom that was caused from a leak, and every time I reported it, the landlord's solution was to put a board over it and paint it. They never fixed the leak, so then the board would mold, it would fall off, and I had this hole for 2 years sitting there, and it's moldy. My children had to live with that. I had to live with that. And I think that the more equitable repair and rent escrow laws would help me be able to put my rent in an escrow while I wait for them to fix that. I've had instances where my toilet wasn't working for a week at a time. My neighbors, 13 of my neighbors' furnaces were leaking gas, and their heat was shut off just this year, and they went for 2 weeks with space heaters in townhomes with upstairs and a downstairs, and the heat laws would help us with that. It's been a difficult time there, but I want to stay there. As I said, I've got roots there. I've become a part of this community with my neighbors and with the surrounding neighborhoods, and I want to be able to stay there, and I want to be able to have the landlord meet the same expectations I have to meet. And again, I just want to tell you that I am very much in support of this bill. It's important to me, it's important to my family, it's important to my community, and I want to encourage you to consider and pass this bill.
The next witness is this Melissa Leonard. Okay, come on up and just state your name and then go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman. My name is Melissa
Can you
Leonard.
Bring the mic closer there.
My name is Melissa Leonard, and I reside in Anoka County. I want to thank you guys for letting me speak this morning. When I was asked to speak today, I wasn't really sure on where to begin. So I decided to start with a question for myself. The question is, have I ever felt that I have failed as a parent, as a mother, and as a shelter provider for my child? On December 3rd, when my three-year-old and I had to live, eat, and sleep, and breathe in a mold-smelling, water-covering, and ice-cold apartment, I felt that I had failed. But was it I who had really failed? I don't think so. I believe that the checks and balance system that works for landlords and tenants failed. I believe that my landlord failed. There is one major fact that any renter could never contest to. Landlords are a part of our life every single day. They affect our health, they affect our children, our jobs, our future in renting and owning, even our credit scores. Reality is they affect every aspect of our lives. They hold all the power while we hold none. Because of my landlord, I have experienced many different things over the last year. Lack of running water, heat. We had sewer overflowing our entire first building to where Anoka County had to come in and completely demolish the whole first floor. Threat of our water and electricity bills being shut off by our utility companies because our landlord has failed to pay. Letters of eviction from my landlord because of invoking tenant rights. I had a wrongful eviction filed against me. The landlord didn't even bother to show up, and his filing fees were, he didn't pay them. Drugs allowed and tolerated in our apartment building. Police there countless times. I couldn't even give you a number. Work orders ignored and denied. My mailbox was tampered with. Keys were not given to me. And my list goes on. So I leave all of you with just one question. My question for you is, has the system failed us as renters? Because I believe it has. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard. Mike, is that the end of it? Okay. Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Leonard and
Ms. Larkin.
And Ms. Larkin. The question that comes to my mind is, why don't you move? We can say that these bad people are doing these things to us, or we can take control of our lives and move to a different place. Why don't you move somewhere else? There's definitely other landlords that probably do a better job, and if people don't take part in a contractual relationship with them, they will either fix a place or they'll go out of business.
Chairman, that's
Leonard?
A perfect question. And I knew that question was going to be asked today, and I was prepared for that. The biggest reason is what landlords ask for. They ask for first and last month's rent. They ask for a $40, $50 fee that you have to pay for an application. I have checked over 30 apartments in Anoka County and Coon Rapids area, and the cheapest that I can find as the down payment for first and last month's rent is about $2,500. That's what they ask. And as a single mom who makes $8 an hour, that's impossible. Absolutely impossible to be able to do something like that. There's no way I could come up with $2,500 to move. I just couldn't do it.
Okay.
Chairman Mulry, Representative.
Ms. Clark.
Thanks for asking that question. I live in Section 8 housing, and the shortest waiting list to get into Section 8 is 3 to 4 years. So it would take me that long to be able to move. It's a very difficult scenario to be in Section 8 housing and find other affordable housing. In addition, I've built up roots in my community. I don't want to have to change my children's school. I don't want to have to travel further to work. And I'm here to ask you to help me. I'm here to try to change how I interact with my landlord, because I believe that the playing field can be leveled fairly easily, and they should have to provide certain basic necessaries.
The chair is going to, we have to make a decision. Maybe we'll have time later, but we have to get through the bills today, and there's like nine parts to each of, roughly 5 to 9 parts of each 4 bills. So these types of questions I'm going to take after if we have time, but I want to get through the bills, and I want to have not just one side, not just legal aid. I want the multi-housing to have their chance to have a full time, too. So these are kind of general questions. We want to get through the bills.
And
Representative Holzman.
Chair Mulry, I think that as I listened to you before we started, if you want some input for us, hopefully we do have some time for questions at the end. So that
Representative Holzman, that was my intent. And that's why I'm worried that we're using up this much time on general things, and I wanted to hear about specific things that are brought up by people during the hearing, so that when both sides go back, they will have the input of the committee as they're negotiating. And I want we really have good negotiations going on this year, and it's kind of like back when I had the working group on foreclosures, they both worked together very well. And so I wanted to get through everything. They can get input from the committee, and then they can work on it. So that's why I'm worried about running out of time on general things like this. So we'll try to open questions at the end.
Mr. Chair, what time could we expect to be open for questions?
Probably at least by a quarter to, I hope.
Thank you.
Larry, do you want to come down? Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Mulry.
What I
I don't think there's, since it's just informal, I don't think we're going to go through presenting bills and moving anything because we're not going to do any action this morning. So I think what we'll just do is I'll explain my bill, and hopefully Representatives Hayden and Clark will get here in time, but I'll present theirs if not, because I went over it initially when Legal Aid came.
Representative Miller, do you want any like time reminders? I want to do my part to keep this moving along.
Yes, I think that probably for sure by 9:30 we'll try and be done with all of the Legal Aid side. I'm sure. I don't think Jack needs more than 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah, okay.
So we'll just try to get through them that way. The first bill, 2668. The first thing on it is all of these are trying to update several issues that have gone unresolved, and this one contains an important part about the federal renter protection law and make sure that Minnesota's current law meshes with it. Our present law doesn't, or is in conflict with the federal law that got passed this last year. So we have no choice but to correct that part of it. And I believe the parties have agreed that the language is okay on that. But they can talk about that if there isn't agreement. The other parts of this bill, one of them is to increase the judicial efficiency by allowing judges to hear eviction expungement motions at the same time that the eviction case itself is heard, rather than having to come back. But there will be restrictions on when that's done. The next is to establish a statewide winter heat code. Some cities have that now. Next one is to create fairness in leases, specifically providing that if a lease requires tenant to pay attorney's fees if the landlord wins a lawsuit against the tenant, that on the other hand, if the tenants should receive attorney's fees if the tenant wins against the landlord, just making it equal that way. Next one is providing advance notice to prospective tenants of what the rental criteria are, so tenants with limited resources will know whether they are or are not qualified and can decide whether or not to offer the application fee. I believe that's close to agreed on. The update the penalty for withholding, unlawfully withholding a security deposit from a tenant. And then the last part of this is giving tenants the option and right to terminate the lease if the property's in foreclosure. And Larry McDonough from, you're still with Legal Aid. He's from Legal Aid, and he also, not just, he's, when I actually was the one that started the Hennepin County Housing Court, and Larry's been an extremely important part of getting that all going and working, and he was with Legal Aid and is still with Legal Aid and is a real expert on this, so turned over to Larry. He's also a great pianist.
Thank you, Representative Mallory, and good morning. I'm also a resident and representative of Paymark District. Nice to see you. And my background on this, I've been doing legal aid work for about 25 years. I'm also a former landlord, so I feel like I don't work as a landlord now. I think I understand both sides of the equation. And, most landlords are good folks. Most tenants are good folks. And most of them do the things that we're really talking about here. And what we're really looking at is coming in and saying for the folks that aren't doing that, where it's really adversely affecting people in pretty substantial ways, to try to put some corrections in there to create a little bit of balance here. So that's really the point of this, is not to punish good landlords, and it's not to make bad tenants have a free rein of things. It's really to kind of create some balance. And I've been coming to legislature, all this time over these 25 years. And really the last time we did something really this kind of I'm not sure what the word is. I'm kind of lost for a word here, but something that's kind of a little more holistic and looks at a larger picture was really back in 1989 of the Governor's Commission on Affordable Housing. We had the foreclosure task force a couple years ago, but that's kind of the, everything else has been kind of a little bit of piecemeal things here and there. So this is really the first time since 1989 to take a larger look at what's going on with landlord-tenant law and see if some things should be tweaked and changed a little bit. Did you want me to say a little bit more on your bill?
Okay.
So with Section 1 is really a clerical change that kind of relates to other changes that we have related to expungement here. It doesn't make any substantive changes in the law. Section 2 on expungement is really to encourage judges and referees to hear the expungement request at the time the actual eviction is done rather than requiring people to come back later. What's really led to this is especially in Hennepin County, they have the expungement hearings on a separate calendar. They're sometimes 2 or 3 months after the actual eviction. And so for a tenant who may be looking for housing in that time that may actually have good grounds for expungement, this eviction's kind of hanging over their head while they're looking around. So it's really the idea is to kind of get that decision done earlier. And I think it actually is a benefit of landlords, too, because landlords are not required to come back to another hearing several months later to give their opinion on whether the file should be expunged or not. So I think the court's actually going to get better information from both sides, and the parties will know at an earlier point in time what exactly the decision is. But it still allows the referees and judges to say, you know, I don't have time. I got to do it later. So, I mean, if they have a reason for putting it off, then put it off. But really to try to get the preference to have it be done sooner than later. The HEAT code is really an attempt to try to have more of a state standard on this. It's really very across the board, across the state. There are a lot of jurisdictions that have minimum codes and some that don't. And, you know, to be honest, this was kind of a tough one to figure out because, you know, we have different climates all over the state. And to say, well, what should the period of time be? And, you know, should it be all year, 68 degrees? Or should it be a certain number of months? It's obviously warmer in Albert Lea than it is up in Roseau. And try to figure in and there are different types of heating plants that people have. So to say it ought to be 68 year-round everywhere with people that are using old boilers, that might be a real big shift in what they're doing. So what we're trying to do is look at the state, look at all the different heat requirements, try to come up with something that was a good balance of what we saw. And there are actually quite a few heating codes around the state, and so we basically surveyed those heating codes to come up with what we came up with. And this doesn't preempt a city code, so if a city code wants to say we want 68 degrees year-round, they're free to do that. But this basically puts a minimum in for parts of the state that don't have it. Section 4, as Representative Mullery said, was really to try to get some equality in the whole attorney's fee thing. This is based on statutes from other states that essentially say if a lease has a provision that says if the landlord wins, they get their attorney's fees paid, that it equates that over to tenants. It doesn't require a landlord to have that provision in the lease. It doesn't require a tenant to request attorney's fees. It doesn't require the landlord to request attorney's fees. But to create a little bit of balance so that if one side's able to get attorney's fees from the other side, that's what we're talking about, a fee that says the other side pays my attorney's fees, that there'd be basically an equality to that and a balance to that. Now, there are some statutes that do say that tenants get attorney's fees if they prevail in a very narrow set of cases, emergency repair cases, lockouts, utility shutoffs, things like that. In terms of my work, the percentage of those cases is very small compared to, like, eviction cases, which are in security deposit cases and conciliation court. That's the large bulk of litigation between landlords and tenants. So the fact that there are some statutes that allow attorney's fees for prevailing tenants and prevailing landlords in very limited situations is a very small subset. And we see these attorney's fee provision in leases a lot. It's a pretty standard provision. Section 5 on tenant screening. Part of what, as was one of the witnesses said, there are a lot of fees that tenants are looking at when they are looking at applying for places. And the problem that tenants run into is paying lots of different application fees at places, and then waiting to see what happens. And so this was an attempt to try to organize this in a way that certainly allows landlords to charge application fees, but kind of structures in a way so that tenants are less likely to have be dangling a lot of application fees and waiting a long time to find out what's going to happen. So a major component is that it follows basically a program in Minneapolis-St. Paul, both by local ordinances, that basically calls for kind of a sequential collection of fees, that you don't collect like 10 application fees from 10 people all at one time, cash them, and then tell 9 of them to wait while they're checking on number one. So that's probably the major thing. There are also some requirements for having things in writing so that tenants are a little more clear what's going on. And also that a landlord not hold it against a tenant that a tenant won an eviction case. You know, certainly as a former landlord, if a tenant had lost an eviction case, I'd certainly want to be able to say that's the reason why I want to exclude this person. And that's perfectly fine under this proposal. But to essentially get landlords out of saying, well, if there's an eviction filed against you, whether you won or lost, you know, you don't get to rent from me. If they've won, that's not a reason for rejecting. On security deposits, Section 6, and you'll have to let me know if I'm going fast enough on this. I'm not obviously the fastest talker in the world, so.
A little bit faster.
Okay, a little bit faster. Okay. Everybody who knows me would understand that criticism. For security deposits to change the bad faith a withholding fee from 200 to 500. It's been sitting at 200 for a long time, and it's quite a bit lower than other types of penalties we have in landlord-tenant statutes. And that's probably the major change on that one. Section 7, this would allow tenants whose landlords are in foreclosure to give a notice to terminate the lease. What we see right now is tenants are in this foreclosure situation. They're looking around for apartments because they know they're going to have to move, and they find something, but then they're kind of stuck and saying, well, you can't really move until the end of all this happens. So it gives them some ability to try to make those choices before the very last minute. Duty to mitigate, this is really something that would follow the law, and I think it's like 42 out of 51 jurisdictions around the country that requires landlords and tenants to mitigate their damages. Basically, a legal word for if someone's done something wrong to you in a contract, that you don't try to like ratchet up the bill so they can sue for a lot. You try to take some efforts to minimize your damages. That's what mitigation is. It doesn't require you to be successful. Just requires you to make the attempt. And right now, in landlord-tenant laws, one of the only areas of contract law in Minnesota where you don't have to do that. Other contract holders who have to do that. Section 9 and 10, as Representative Mulry said, was to really conform the state notice provisions in foreclosures for tenants to the federal ones. So we've got federal 90-day notice, we have a state 2-month notice, and how they interact is kind of complicated. A lot of banks don't know which notice they should be giving. A lot of tenants don't know which one they're supposed to receive. This would really conform it for the period that the federal law is around. When the federal law sunsets, this would sunset as well.
And I just want to explain about the last part, that we had thought of just having the federal law there and leaving our old statute, but then people reading the statute as to what to do might not know about the federal law and how it conflicted, so we decided to get an agreed-upon language that would be used, that was agreed upon by both sides for that period while the federal law is in existence. So I believe that language is agreeable, and if not, it's extremely close on agreement. That's all on that bill, and then I don't think Representative Hayden Clark still aren't here, so I guess we'll just go ahead on their bill. And their two bills I haven't looked at since I met with Mr. Elwood for 3.5 hours before we started this. So I'm just going to let Larry go ahead on these.
Representative Mulry, we do have Representative Champion's bill, and he is here. I just want to make sure that we also allow enough time for that one. So
right.
You're going to, okay.
And I'm a friend of Ron Elwood, so I can give you my condolences for spending 3 hours with him, and hopefully you've done okay with that. I believe the next bill is House File 2829, And this also has some provisions on expungement in Section 1 and Section 2. And this would essentially do a couple of things. Right now, there's common law, there's court-derived law on expungement that's different from the statute. And this allows the statute to kind of encompass that and allow basically two different types of expungements. One that's more permissive, where the land basically follows the common law.
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry. My apologies, Representative Chen.
You get to do that in
okay.
a few minutes.
Thanks for stopping me there. I'm a parent of three daughters, and they're always telling me what I'm doing wrong, and so I won't have any problems with having done that. Okay, my apologies again. Okay, so would 2985 be okay then?
Yes.
Okay. So 2985, Section 1 is to add some regulation into the late fee area. Right now, late fees are regulated by the common law. There are a number of court decisions that say kind of how to do it and how not to do it, but obviously most tenants and landlords don't read the common law, and so this is an attempt to codify that so it's a little more clear, and also to regulate it a little bit. We see quite a disparity in very large late fees, some that accrue on a daily basis. I've seen, you know, $50 a day late fees and late fees that really add up very fast. So this was an attempt to regulate that and take standards out of other statutes to put a cap on the late fee. And to give a tenant a 5-day grace period, which a lot of leases do already, to pay the rent before getting a late fee. Number two is to require Section 2 is to require a receipt for rent. A lot of tenants pay by money order and pay by cash, and there's really no documentation of kind of when that occurred. And so this is a statute to essentially require a landlord to do that. Immediate receipt if it's done in person, or a mailed receipt if the rent is paid by mail. There's no penalty in the statute, so it doesn't say that there's going to be some whopping penalty, but it's basically to try to get landlords and tenants in the practice of documenting their transactions. Section 3 would put a cap on security deposits. There was some testimony about that already. It's very common in my practice to see tenants having to pay a lot of money to move on from one place to another, which essentially kind of locks them into where they're living, where they're living is a good place or not. And Section 4 is to allow, make sure I've got my right section here. So Section 4 is to allow tenants in emergency situations to give a notice and basically pay for emergency repairs rather than having to file an action to do that. I'm not going to mince any words about this. There's a big difference from what we have right now. But we have tenants in emergency situations where there's no heat, where things are falling apart in a very emergency way, and they have to go to court and wait for a court hearing to get orders to do this. This allows them to give what we believe is a reasonable notice to the landlord to correct it, and if the landlord doesn't correct it, allows the tenant to then pay for that and to deduct it from rent.
A little faster.
Okay.
Done
yeah, I'm done with that.
Oh, good. You're on time then.
I'll still try to be fast.
We'll try to do 5 minutes for each.
Okay, all right. 2816, I'll have to go hyperventilate when I'm done. This is like really fast for me. So check in with me out in the hallway and make sure I'm okay. The first four sections of 2816 deal with use of single meter utility services, basically what we call shared meters, where there's a 1 meter that covers a number of different units in a household or in a rental property, which makes it very difficult for tenants to basically kind of control their utility expenses because they're being averaged out with other tenants. And so this law makes a number of changes there. It introduces the use of sub-metering, which is actually used quite a bit around the country, and also puts more language about defining how to spread out a shared meter bill over a number of tenants to make sure that it really is equitable rather than having it be a little more amorphous right now. And clarifies the penalty that's already in the statute in Section 4. There was some basically confusion over whether that penalty, the penalty that's already in the statute, applied to the shared meter situation. This would clarify that it does. Section 5 is related to tenant screening agencies, and this would require a tenant screening agency to wait on reporting on an eviction case until there's a decision. Part of the problem right now is somebody files a case and the tenant screening agencies report it very quickly, and it gets into the database, and so even if the tenant wins the case and gets it expunged later, they have to wait quite a bit before that gets changed. They basically say, wait till there's an outcome. Once you have an outcome, like tenant won, tenant lost, then go ahead and report that. But not report the case until there is an outcome. That's not a huge delay. I mean, eviction cases go very fast, you know, in a number of days, sometimes weeks, but very fast compared to other types of litigation. Number six is to allow a tenant to get out of the lease if they need to get in, basically because of infirmity, need to get into a nursing home or some other facility. This is patterned after a statute we already have that allows domestic abuse victims to do it. The tenant has to give a two-month notice and to basically pay some additional rent to get out, but allows them to make that transition and not be on the hook for the lease when they really need to be somewhere else. And we think it gives adequate notice for the landlord to react. Section 7 is actually something that we are going to be doing an amendment to pull out of this bill. Section 7 is basically very similar to the section we already talked about with the federal foreclosure laws and the state foreclosure laws, and the other one was really meant to supersede this one, but this one didn't get out of the bill. So this one is one that we would be retracting from it because we've got the other one already there. Section 8 is a pay or quit notice statute. It's based on statutes that we have in a lot of other states, and it's also based on rules that we already have in public and subsidized housing, where a landlord would have to give a short notice before filing an eviction case for non-payment of rent. We've done some research of how quickly landlords file cases, and for instance, in Hennepin County in January, there are about 1,000 cases filed. Only about 12 cases would have been delayed by having the statute. Most landlords don't go that fast, and this would basically give the tenant basically the notice that, you know, if you don't pay this in 7 days, there is going to be an eviction case. We think it's actually going to lead to less eviction cases because the tenant's either going to pay that or they're going to tell the landlord, you know, I can't pay it, maybe I should go. And so we think it's going to save landlords money, and we think it's going to help both landlords and tenants. Section 9 is a notice with a right to cure, a 7-day notice. So if landlord says, tenant, you're doing something wrong, this gives a tenant some time to change that before the landlord files an eviction case. This is just like what's in public and subsidized housing. It's also like what we have in manufactured home parks. And we're hopeful that we think, just like in public and subsidized housing, it will reduce eviction cases because it says the tenant, this is what you're doing wrong, change it, or I'm going to file an eviction case against you. So the tenant knows they've got the choice. I'm either going to change this thing, or I better leave. I can't change this. I better leave if I don't want the eviction on the record. So hopefully that was a little faster.
Okay. Then have Representative Champion come up while I'm going back. So.
Good morning.
Again, my apologies.
Oh, no problem. Good morning, committee. Thank you for an opportunity to take a look at my bill this morning, and I know that it's going to be laid over, but let me give you the basis as to why I think this is important. There have been cases that I've had where I've gone to housing court, and even though the parties all agree, you know what, we shouldn't be here, and let's agree to an expungement. At that particular moment, even though they agree, the judge is not allowed at that particular time to even hear the issue of expungement because the hearing is on a separate date. Well, what will that require? That now will require the tenant to now file a separate motion, provide a separate fee, and now you got to wait. I think it's judicial efficiency for the judge to be given the authorization or the leeway to make a decision right at that moment. The second thing that I think is important is that even under the current law, as I understand it, even if the parties agree, that would not be a basis for expungement. Even if the parties agree. And so I think this bill, quickly, that we're going to walk through, sort of addresses those issues, and I think it's reasonable for both sides to agree to the provisions that are outlined in my bill. So with that, Larry, can you proceed?
Okay. Nice to see you again. In sections 1 and 2, this gets at the categories of basically discretionary and mandatory expungement. The discretionary part really takes what already is the common law that allows the court to do an expungement where there's an important change of circumstances that really means that it would be fair for expungement, even though the landlord didn't do anything wrong. I had a case a few years ago with a couple of young girls who were friends of the kids that were killed in the Cold Spring shootings. They were young adults. They were going back and forth to Cold Spring, and they put the rent on the table, but neither one had paid it. And the landlord thought they had spaced out on the rent, filed an eviction case. Landlord didn't do anything wrong. They came back, they paid it up, and they kept staying there. And they did a request for expungement. The expungement was denied because the landlord hadn't done anything wrong. And, you know, and these gals were good gals, you know, and they did the wrong thing, but, you know, they weren't like, they weren't the mad bomber tenants. I mean, they were good folks. And this would basically kind of put into the statute that ability to say that that's a good place to do an expungement. And then it also has a mandatory expungement where the tenant won the case, which we think is a fair bet, and where the landlords and the parties have made landlord and tenant have made an agreement about that. So we think this just puts a little more protection for tenants that really are deserving of that kind of protection. And certainly, there are going to be a lot of eviction cases that aren't going to get expunged. Most of them don't get expunged. Tenant doesn't pay the rent. They don't have a good reason. Landlord files a case. Tenant moves. It's still going to be out there, and landlords are going to be able to find out about that. Section 3 deals with a problem where courts, for, you know, good reasons, are destroying court files to save space. The problem is that if a tenant in, like, Hennepin County files a motion for expungement on an eviction case that's 2 years old, the file's already gone. The file's already destroyed. And it's really hard to kind of piece together what the situation ought to be on that. And so this puts a presumption that if the file's been destroyed, a presumption in favor of expungement, but certainly allows the landlord to come in and say, wait a second, you know, this is not a good case for expungement. Allows the referee to inquire to really figure out of the tenant, is this a good case for expungement? But kind of tips the balance a little bit in the favor of the tenant when the courts have destroyed the file. And believe me, I've done some of these cases, and these are hard when you're basically trying to recreate what happened when all the documents are gone. And the last thing, Section 4 is similar to what we talked about in an earlier bill and what Representative Champion just talked about moving up that time for expungement where both sides can really talk about it right when they're there in the eviction case, and both landlords and tenants don't have to wait and come back and pay extra expense. You raise a good point. If you have to come back and file the motion for the expungement, you're paying that extra filing fee to come back rather than have it done right there. So,
Are you done with the bill, Larry?
I'm sorry, yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry.
The intentional ouster.
Right, intentional ouster. Sorry, trying to make as many mistakes here as possible. Section six. This deals with a situation that, to be honest, it doesn't affect a lot of people. But I've had some cases where a tenant has died, and the personal representative wants to come to the property to start figuring out what to do, and the landlord changes the locks on that person, and then they can't come in, and then they're going to have to go to probate court or something and try to figure out how to get back in. And this is really to change the statute to allow that person, if they do get locked out, to be able to file a case and say, you know, I am the right person to come in. This doesn't require the landlord to open their doors to anybody who comes over. This doesn't allow the landlord to give, doesn't require the landlord to give keys to people and just try to figure out who should be coming and who should be going. It's basically trying to get the landlord out of the business of even figuring that out. That's for the estate to figure out, not for the landlord to kind of lock folks out. So again, this is not a huge problem in terms of the population, but when it affects people, it's pretty big for those that are affected. Now I think I'm supposed to be done.
And that's the bill.
You finished, Larry?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Just perfect timing. So we can give Mr. Arner his share.
Perfect, Mr. Chair.
It's perfect. I'm not.
Larry's always perfect. Mr. Horner, Jack. Just try to wrap up about a quarter or two so the committee can ask some questions and comments. Thanks very much.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. And appreciate your consideration and working together. And as has been stated before, we are indeed in the process of attempting to do that. I'm going to just go through and just briefly state our concern about some of the larger issues that you've heard discussed and give you a flavor of the kinds of things that we're concerned about and or have hope that we can reach agreement on. First of all, the federal conformity with federal foreclosure law is fine. We do think it needs some tweaking. It doesn't actually reflect the federal law in our opinion, but you know, I think we're there, and certainly in concept. The hearing at the eviction action, the hearing for expungement at the eviction action, we think might have some grounds for being something we can work with. Our concern, of course, is that it's going to trigger a great number of expungements. We think landlords have to know whether or not a tenant was evicted. It's an important part of the information that a tenant needs, a landlord needs. So we're very concerned about greatly increasing the number of expungements. We assume that if you allow the motion at the eviction hearing, that virtually all, most if not all, tenants would ask for it. I mean, why wouldn't you? And so we expect that there would be a huge burden on the court, possibly, hearing them right then and there, and possibly a lot more of them. So we want some safeguards built into them, for example, that would say that if a tenant, that a tenant can ask for it only if he prevails, that a landlord would always have a right to speak to the expungement, even if he had agreed, which often they are required to do as part of a settlement, not to oppose an expungement. Heating requirements statewide, we think, is unwieldy for a number of reasons. First of all, the dates are somewhat arbitrary. The geographic imbalance has been mentioned. Large buildings take a while to convert from heat to air conditioning and back and forth. You and I in our single family homes, I mean, come October 1, we don't automatically crank on the furnace. In fact, you hope you don't have to. And we hope maybe you don't have to run it after April 1 with any luck, maybe. So it's very unwieldy. This puts into state law in the covenants of habitability section a legal ability of a tenant to simply determine for himself that the building, that his apartment is not 68 degrees, whether he's left the windows open or for whatever reason, and withhold the rent. It kicks it into the withholding the rent part. So a tenant could just automatically withhold the rent. The thing about city ordinances is that to enforce them, you call the inspector. Now the inspector comes out. He has the ability to measure. He has the ability to make the necessary judgments as to whether or not the apartment is properly heated or cooled. 40-some cities, and actually more in our count, have ordinances like this already, so it's not as though the subject isn't being addressed. The attorney's fees, the reciprocal attorney's fees, most statutes, landlord-tenant statutes, already allow a tenant to recover attorney's fees. So if a tenant goes to court or a rent escrow action or tenants, the tenant can recover. Of 11 statutes that allow attorney's fees, 8 are the tenant only. The others are prevailing party. So a landlord is just trying to protect himself by putting into his contract what is already generally the law for tenants. And to come back and kind of penalize the landlord saying, well, you're trying to protect yourself, we're going to fool you and make it come back on you, we think is not right or fair, and it's not needed because of the statutes. The tenant applicant screening, the concept that you screen tenants one at a time, the tenant is either accepted or not, or offered a tenancy, and then you go on to the next one. We're fine with that concept. Again, there's a lot of provisions that need some work, but we think that that concept is something that we can work with. Other things probably don't bear mentioning. The right of a tenant of a foreclosed property to terminate the tenancy, we think is very bad public policy. During the period of a foreclosure, of course, the property owner is trying to redeem. He's trying to come up with the money to pay his mortgage, to redeem the mortgage. To allow a tenant to simply move and deprive that income stream, empty a building potentially, we think is just disastrous to landlords, to neighborhoods, to promote vacant buildings like that or vacant units. Tenants in foreclosed properties already have a lot of law on their side, and there's more coming. Notices, limitations on the leases that can be recreated, post-foreclosure requirements to allow the tenant to live there, etc. So we think that there's a lot of protection for tenants already and need not go to the point that would be very harmful to properties in the foreclosure process. The duty to mitigate, the concept being that if a landlord, a tenant, breaches his lease by abandoning the property, that it shifts the burden onto the landlord to fix it. Now, the landlord's the aggrieved party. He's the one who's going to lose rent. But if a tenant abandons, the landlord would, under this, have the duty, for example, to re-rent that unit first, rather than the two or three or a dozen or whatever else he has that he's already on the hook for that are running vacant. So now he'd have to fill the unit that the breaching party, the tenant, is actually responsible for, but this shifts the duty to the landlord to attempt to make best effort to attempt to re-rent it. Mitigation is a foreign concept to real estate law. Of course, it's in contract law. This is real estate. You don't mitigate, you don't have to mitigate in real estate law because real estate is considered, each parcel is considered an individual or unique parcel. Going on, there's provisions in one of the bills that regarding expungements that would greatly expand the number of expungements of eviction actions. Again, very concerned. It would allow, for example, just a flavor of it, it would allow expungement of evictions when the judge determines that the tenant his circumstances have changed to the extent it's no longer a reasonable predictor of his future behavior. Unlawful detainer expungements are very brief, essentially undocumented affairs. Current law allows expungements, and we support this, and we have, and we support the legislation in current law, that says that if a landlord files an eviction action by mistake, he files an eviction for non-payment, and in fact the tenant did pay, and his bookkeeping made a mistake or something, well, of course the tenant should get that expunged. There's no issue about that. We do not want judges to be able to determine that a tenant has been rehabilitated or changed his circumstances. In eviction expungement actions, the judge has no documentation about that at all, far different than common law expungements or our criminal statute regarding expungements of crimes, where you have reports, you have probate officer or parole officer, you have documentation, has this tenant really been rehabilitated, criminal, really been rehabilitated, and should his criminal record be expunged? Nothing like that at all in evictions. So the judge would just, the landlord is usually not even there. So the tenant would come and say, my circumstances have changed. That's the only evidence on the book. The judge would have no reason to say, well, I guess you're right, and order the expungement. This mandates expungements if there are agreements. Landlords frequently enter into agreements to allow expungements or to permit them or to not oppose them as part of the settlement agreement. It's commonly done. Tenants have wised up. They simply require that as part of the settlement. Often, not all the time, of course. Often they require tenants, landlords, to agree not to oppose an expungement. If you're going to have a hearing on an expungement, you have to allow the landlord to be able to present his side of the case, even though he may have been required to enter into an agreement. The landlord's motivation to enter into the agreement, because maybe the tenant will agree to pay the rent or agree to move at a fixed time if the expungement is allowed. So landlords have motivation to do that. But then you have a tenant who has rightfully been evicted, and the next landlord won't be able to find that out. Destroyed court files, I think, speaks for itself. Just because a court file is destroyed because of ordinary record-keeping management, there's no reason why that then creates a presumption that the tenant should have his expungement, unlawful detainer expungement. The personal representation allowing into the unit, very much of a concern. The only real issue that arises with any frequency is the landlord may not know the correct identity and responsibility and authority of the person appearing before him. A person appears before him and says, I'm the guy, my brother wanted me to clean out the apartment. Landlords have a duty, a statutory duty as well as common law, to not give the tenant stuff to the wrong party. If he does, and then later on the right party comes by, the landlord's liable. He's responsible not only for the stuff given away, which could be a lot, I mean, if a tenant dies in a unit, but also penalties, civil penalties. So the landlord's got to be very careful to have proper authorization, maybe a copy of the court order, a copy of the will, or someone can prove that he really is the authorized representative, power of attorney maybe. This doesn't solve any of that. It simply puts pressure on a landlord to allow an unknown person into the unit. Landlords sometimes do change the locks. You don't want people just entering a unit and taking stuff, or vandalizing the unit, or throwing a party in the unit. So sometimes you do change the locks. The landlord has duty to be careful about this, about who he's letting into the unit. Landlords, of course, want to get rid of the stuff. That is their motivation, but to give it to the right party. Late fees. We're okay with putting it in writing, as has been suggested, as probably the law anyway. We think it is. But a statute to put it in writing, you know, a requirement for a tenant to pay a late fee is fine. We don't think an exact amount. The amount in the bill is very low. We would absolutely need a higher amount. Whether the other side would go for an amount that we think is right, I don't know. Right now, it is common law. You can't charge a late fee that constitutes a penalty. I won't explore that further, but obviously in any of this, the questions, I'd be happy to respond to them. Limitation on security deposits we think is counterproductive for many reasons. One example, landlords will often, if they have a tenant who applies and is marginal income, marginal credit, they'll often say, well, I'll rent to you, but you're going to have to pay your last month's rent in advance. Or sometimes it's a co-signer. Properties in different areas have different security needs, have different needs for a deposit. Having a one-size-fits-all works to the detriment of good tenants and to those tenants who want to get into a unit and to the neighborhoods. Repair and deduct for emergency repairs. This is the old chestnut, been around for eons. We oppose it. We don't think it's a good idea to allow tenants to fix a building on their own, which this allows. The tenant would have to give notice to the landlord, I'm going to do it, but there's nothing in here that it would allow a landlord to stop it or control the process or say, you know, I don't have to have my entire furnace replaced. How about you just put in a new filter or something? So this, the idea of giving tenants the ability to fix somebody else's building, well, I mean, it speaks for itself. We oppose that. That's enough of that. There's a couple other smaller things, but single meter building amendments, there's a provision. This is the situation where one utility meter serves more than one tenant in a building. Current law says that the landlord has to be the customer. And that's, but the landlord then can recover his costs either by simply building into the rent, the most commonly was done, or under statutory requirements, provisions, he can rebuild the tenant. This would say that if the landlord uses a sub-meter, it has to meet certain standards. We can work with that. We don't know what the standards are or whether these standards apply. We'd have to look into all of that. But, I mean, the concept that you have a sub-meter that works, obviously, is fine. The other provision, under current law, a landlord is able to what's called equitably apportion the bill among the tenants, like if there's no sub-meters. This goes way too far. Requires you, landlords to literally examine the lifestyle of the tenants, examine whether they're living green and saving energy. I guess you'd count the showers they take or something, and you'd have to figure out exactly how and what style of life they're living and many other requirements, essentially making this unworkable. Let's see. Tenants, we already talked about that. A tenant screening that you would not, a tenant screening agency would not be able to disclose that a court case has been filed, an eviction court case has been filed. I mean, just the filing of it, they'd be permitted from disclosing. Number one, this is all public knowledge. I mean, this is a strong deprivation of what anybody can get by going to the court files or looking in the newspaper. It's public knowledge. Secondly, and even more importantly, from a policy point of view, when a tenant's been evicted, it's that first time period, that first couple of weeks, that he's out looking for a place to live, obviously. And so at that critical time, a landlord would not be able to find out. He'd be deprived, at least by his tenant screening company, of knowledge that that tenant, at least there's a pending eviction. Now, they're identified that way. Landlords are required to give the outcome when the outcome's available, but when it's pending, the future landlord should at least have that knowledge that this is an eviction pending. Terminating the tenancy on infirmity is way too broad. You can terminate it for any particular number of reasons. You get any number of reasons. I mean, it's not stated. You get a doctor's note, and you can terminate the tenancy moving into, say, an assisted living or an apartment with services. Way too broad and not needed. The system works now. Tenants often come to a landlord and say, you know, I might be moving. And so they get a month-to-month tenancy or a clause in their lease, sometimes called a transfer clause. Or I might be building a house. They get a buy or build clause into their lease. If they know that they're going to be needing to move or might be needing to move, these things are readily handled under current law. Tenant's right to cure simply gives them 7 more days. A tenant has 7 days more to pay the rent. It simply delays the process, puts another burden in having to evict a tenant. Right now, tenants have a right to redeem, and they have a right to pay the rent, really right up to the time of the court, right up to the time they're evicted. This says you'd have to give a letter of 7 days. Well, first of all, it's the so-called trap for the unwary. It's an additional procedural requirement. You'd have to give this notice to the tenant, or you can't evict. Now, there are some provisions like that in subsidized housing, but you've agreed to that as part of the subsidies. Finally, that is finally. Good, I've been through them. Thank you, Madam. Mr. Chairman, thank you, and members. 3 minutes late, but.
I think the committee will forgive you. There's some questions, I believe, that people had. Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can start with Mr. Horner. We heard story of a tenant in Section 8 housing, and over the years, my recollection is that many landlords choose not to participate in Section 8 housing because of all the rules and regulations. Would, under current regulations governing Section 8 housing and protections for the tenants, would they allow a situation that was put up on a board to continue without the tenant having ability to address that?
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, I do not understand the testimony that was presented. Absolutely not. Annual inspections for Section 8 are required. I just can't imagine of a Section 8 inspector allowing that kind of situation to go on. The tenant who stated these things, I don't know why the various remedies didn't work. You call the city. The city inspector comes out. Well, of course they're going to write up orders and require the landlord to fix them under severe penalties if you don't. There are the rent, the court actions. The tenant who testified said, the Section 8 tenant, the solution to all of this is a rent escrow action. We have a rent escrow action in the state of Minnesota. We also have a Tenants' Remedies Act and another kind of a court case. You can withhold rent. I mean, the most powerful remedy at all. If you don't like the condition of your apartment, just don't pay the rent. You may end up having to defend it in an unlawful detainer. I mean, I agree with that, and maybe not very pleasant, but you would win, you know, assuming what you said is accurate, and you would be able to deduct some of, or all of your rent. Numerous remedies for this kind of a situation. I truly am mystified why this went on for so long, particularly in a Section 8 building.
Representative Champion. Oh, I'm sorry. Got to go in order. Representative Johnson, then Champion, then Westrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this is a question for Representative Champion. Looking at your bill on the discretionary expungement, what's your reaction to Mr. Horner's thinking that the judge wouldn't have sufficient information to make a determination on expungement? Is that accurate, or how accurate is it? What's your thoughts on it? Just a little more information.
I believe that if I understand your question clearly, and if I don't, you know, just ask me again. But I believe that at the time of the eviction hearing, and I think it's kind of timely because if, for example, the person had withheld rent, using his scenario, and had in fact then been taken to eviction court, they would have won. At the time of presenting that information to the housing court judge, that tenant still could not get their record expunged. They'd have to do a separate hearing. Now, whether the judge has all the information, I believe the judge would have all the information. And I believe that under the discretionary rule or portion of this bill, that it should be expanded because there's some scenarios and situations that the court should listen to and hear and weigh as it pertains to whether an expungement should be granted. And I truly believe that the judge would have all of the information. The landlord would be there. The tenant would be there. Everyone would be there.
Okay. Representative Champion, your next question.
Well, in fact, I presented my question just in the scenario because he asked me this direct question, but I was going to ask our testifier if whether they would agree that there would be a need to allow the housing court judge to make the decision about the expungement, especially if it is believed at that particular time that the tenant was right, and whether the housing court judge should have the authority.
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Champion, no. In general, as we said, on principle, we're okay with exploring the idea of having an expungement motion right then and there at the UD hearing. We think, first of all, the landlord's there. They generally are not at a later motion. And so the judge has not much to go on other than the two or three pages. So you have the landlord right there. And there are other reasons. But the other side, of course, is that there would be a burden on the court. This topic has come up before the Hennepin County Housing Court Advisory Committee, which we sit on, and they're very concerned. They say, God, this could slow down evictions. I mean, they already have 10,000 a year, so this could dramatically slow down. So that's why there's a phrase in there saying that the court may decide not to hear it at the time of the eviction hearing, the motion for good cause. Other concerns that we have is we want to make sure that since the concept is the landlord's there, we want to make sure the landlord isn't hamstrung by an agreement not to oppose the UD. I mean, the concept of having the landlord at the hearing is he can speak up. Thirdly and finally, current law says that if it's a meritless eviction by mistake or meritless, the landlord clearly wins, and sometimes it's not clear if the landlord won or not. I mean, if a tenant vacates because you had to file a UD on him, you can't say the tenant won because the case was dismissed. Or if the tenant exercises his right to redeem and pays the rent, you can't say the tenant won. The landlord had to file to get the rent. But if the tenant just clearly wins, the landlord was wrong, I can't imagine why that wouldn't be expunged under current law.
Representative Champion, follow-up?
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is it not true, though, even under current law, that there would have to be a separate petition put forward, there would be separate filing, and that, in fact, if the landlord believed it to be very important, they would, in fact, have the right to show up and be able to argue that point under current law? But is it also much more judicially efficient for it to happen at one proceeding where we are sure that the landlord there is there, and we're sure that the tenant is there, and it cuts down on cost and time for everyone? Wouldn't you agree with that?
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with that. The way you presented it, and in general, I agree with that. In Hennepin County, it is a separate, well, it's always a separate motion, could be oral. In Hennepin County, it is a separate hearing. Other counties don't. Other counties will order expungements right from the bench, particularly if the landlord says, well, I don't oppose to it. But yes, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, I've been on another committee too often. Mr. Chairman and Representative Champion, yes, we agree with your statement as presented.
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, I've got a few questions. First to Mr. Horner, and then maybe the prior testifiers could respond. Regarding the statewide heat requirement, could that not also set a ceiling of heat as well? And in scenarios where somebody wants it warmer than 68, wouldn't the landlord have the law met by just setting it at 68? Especially if the landlord's providing the heat to the building. And let me just ask you another question: wouldn't that already fall under warranty of habitability standards if a tenant didn't have heat to their facility in December?
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, first of all, yes, I think it could lead to confusions. I mean, in April or October, you may want the air conditioning on, not the heat in some years. Secondly, literally, you may want to continue that. Secondly, as we all know, that often floors become ceilings, ceilings become floors. I mean, you just automatically go to whatever you minimally have to do. Thirdly, and finally, it would indeed be a habitability issue. Now, maybe not just a couple of degrees. And we don't want a tenant to be able to withhold rent because he determines it's 67, so I'm not going to pay the rent. But if you call the housing inspector and he does his measurements and says, yes, indeed, your heating system is deficient. Under housing maintenance codes, under building code, of course, you have to have a properly functioning furnace. And if you have any serious heat problems, it absolutely triggers habitability laws.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Westrom,
just a follow-up on that scenario. We just installed an electric boiler system in our house a year and a half ago. This year, when we've had these cold days of 20 and 30 below, I honestly don't think our house got over 68 degrees because our boiler couldn't handle it. I mean, it just didn't seem to keep up. What are we going to do in situations like that? Oversize? I mean, I suppose that's the scenario. Oversize it. I got to believe those situations happen, and we got cold weather here. Sometimes we just have to put sweatshirts on. But let me move on to the escrow issue in this scenario. I think it's been covered a little bit. But I'm just struck that with Section 8 inspectors, all the vacancies that are out there in buildings and foreclosure, how some of those earlier examples could not have been remedied, or somebody from the government that's doing this inspecting doesn't seem like they're even following what's already current law. And I guess my question is, wouldn't an escrow be the right scenario under that, if not moving? And I mean, my experience is anytime you add more requirements to the landlord, you've got an option of the more you pay, oftentimes the better your apartment or your house is going to be. And it seems to me that moving to a different place that's nicer, that you can afford, would be the option, and let competition clean out this building, and the landlord's going to either have to clean it up, fix it up, or go
Mr.
broke.
Mr. Horner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, yes, I mean, I agree with what you've said. I do understand that moving is kind of your last resort. You don't just tell a tenant who's not happy, well, why don't you just move? Although tenants do all the time because they want different features or location, or they want to have a pool, or for thousands of reasons. It's not like it's unknown. Tenants move all the time. But in general, yes, there are numerous remedies, including the one that the speaker said, there ought to be a rent escrow action. Well, there is.
Quick or
easy? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McDonough, you wanted to answer this, I believe.
Yeah. First of all, you know, the inspection departments and inspectors vary a lot, and I've been doing this for a long time, and I've been shocked a lot of times and heartened a lot of times. There are cases where really serious things don't get addressed very quickly. And part of what we're here again is not about the good landlords. I mean, I felt like I was a good landlord when I was. And if a tenant called up and said the heat's not working, even if it was 11 o'clock at night and I was tired and I had a day job, it was my job to get over there and get it fixed or pay somebody to do it. And most landlords do that. But there are some that don't. And a lot of what we're here about are about the folks that don't, and to try to get some clarity for what the rules are. You know, right now, if there are bad repair problems, the tenant doesn't have the right to move. I mean, they can physically move, but they have liability issues if they move. So that's part of why we've got the 48-hour notice thing here, to say, you know, get working on this, landlord. The good landlords, you know, like I tried to be, would already had it done, you know. But the ones that aren't, for whatever reasons, it's like if they don't get that serious thing done, the tenant then has some options. They may have that option to give the 7-day notice, maybe they move. Maybe they give the 48-hour notice and they take care of it themselves. But again, it's to try to deal with these folks that you know, maybe they shouldn't be landlords, you know, but they are. And it's really hard for a tenant to move, knowing, one, am I going to have liability if I move, and two, can I front that deposit in last month's rent and first month's rent to move when I don't have that parked in the bank?
There's three more people that want to talk, and unless there's a huge objection, we have a little extra time because it's a half-hour break, so I think we could go 10 minutes, and then we could get in the questions from those three people, if that's okay with the... because I realize we put a lot on today, but they all interact, and so... Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple of things. I'm a landlord. I've got apartments and commercial space. I personally find that 48-hour notice rule to be very reasonable. I figure that it's our job, and we have had things go very, very wrong. And, you know, once it was a big plumbing problem, and it was opening deer season, and finding a plumber in Mille Lacs, Minnesota, or anywhere nearby was almost impossible, but we kept trying, and we found one. The other thing, and I do not buy the argument that that mutuality of attorney's fees is somehow unfair. I don't buy it at all. There may be other statutes that already, you know, give the tenant attorney's fees if tenant prevails. Fine. You're not losing anything. So I just, you know, maybe you want to restate why that could be unfair, because that seems incredibly fair.
Just one second. Somebody has a cell phone on, so please turn it off. I think she was asking Mr. Horner. That's my understanding, yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, thank you, Representative Jackson. Well, first of all, as you mentioned, landlord-tenant law statutes already give tenants that kind of protection. They do not give landlords that protection. So if it's fair for one, it ought to be fair for the other. Of the 11 statutes that we found that grant attorney's fees, we found that only one of them is for the landlord. A couple of them are prevailing party, and all the rest of them, the eight, are the other of the 11, are for tenants. So landlords build in that provision in their lease because they have to, because the law hasn't done it. Secondly, what the language of this would do is say if a landlord has a attorney fee provision in any of his, for example, just unlawful detainers, that it automatically would trigger tenants' attorney's fees for any kind of an action. We think that that's not right. We are very fearful of providing the kind of incidental, subtle incentive attorney's fees give. This is, I think, amply noted by attorneys in human rights law and others, that if you provide attorney's fees, it provides an incentive. Finally, and from a very practical point...
Excuse me, but you do have attorney's fees for the landlord. I mean, your incentive argument, it works both ways.
Well Mr. Horner... Mr. Chairman, excuse me.
Answer a little quicker so we can get the other two questions.
Landlords
in.
Do not evict because they want to. They only do it when they have to. I mean, landlords are business people. They want to keep their customers. Eviction is not something you have an incentive to do. From a very practical point of view, finally, attorney's fees almost in essence are not fair. If tenants ask for them, they can get them and they can collect. They don't always get them, but if they do get them, they can collect. Landlords, probably not. Okay. So it's more of an incentive rather than the actual remuneration that a landlord
can. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I also am a landlord. And a lot of what we've discussed today here, we have in our own separate apartment rules that we have tenants sign. And so I just wanted to put that out there, that most of this can be solved before entering into a lease, if both parties agree to it. As far as the expungement, I wanted to just visit that issue for a minute, and the whole thing with tenants not being able to apply for an apartment if there's an expungement on the record. We take it on a case-by-case basis ourselves. We want to rent to people when we have a vacancy. We want to, and we want to work it out with people. So if they have a good explanation for that expungement being on the record, some of them even bring letters from their landlord saying, this has been solved. And part of the application process is you have whoever does the screening, or if you're doing the screening yourself as a landlord, you call and you talk to the prior landlord to find out, you know, what kind of tenant this person has been, and what, I see there's an unlawful detainer, can you explain that? Have you collected on that, or is that solved? We've also had the case where we've expunged in court during an eviction case, and later that person didn't come back to the table with their end of the bargain. So I just see a lot of this as being very skewed to the tenant. And again, like Mr. Horner said, we're in business. We want to keep our customers, and we want to act in good faith. We don't want tenants to leave. It's expensive for us. And I guess more than anything, I don't have a question. I just wanted to make those few comments. Thank you.
Holberg, last question.
Yeah, and just real briefly, I have major problems with the 68 degrees. I can't even remember when my thermostat at home has been set at 68 degrees. I don't tell my son that he would have a right to have his part of the house at 68 degrees, because he doesn't. But what are the standards? You said 40 cities had standards. I mean, when we put in a new thermostat, it automatically goes down to like 60-something at night. And I mean, when I read that, I'm just like, what are they thinking?
Mr. Dahl, you want to answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I have a list here of cities with a population over 5,000. There are 43 cities that have a heat code that says, and it's roughly in the range of 68 degrees between these dates. We sort of picked the average. There are other cities, there's about 60 cities that have building codes that say that there needs to be equipment that can heat the property up to 68 degrees. They don't actually require that. And then there's another smaller handful of cities over 5,000 that have no code whatsoever. So if you want to take a look at that, you can. The 68 degrees is what we used as the average of what we were seeing other cities were doing and what other states were doing. And so we're trying to come to what we think is a, and maybe Mr. McDonough can talk about this, the state law is not very firm on this. In fact, what is firm enough is something that is very determined by, you know, the judge that's hearing the case. And what does loss of heat mean?
And just if I might, so you said you took the average, so are you telling me there are cities that require heat above 68 degrees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, there are a couple of cities that go to 70 and have up to May 1st. We didn't take that.
Wow.
Representative McDonough, I'm sorry I had to defame you and call you a representative, Mr. McDonough.
That's okay. I've been messing up well enough. You guys are all doing better than I am. Right. A lot of what we're doing here is to try to give guidance to landlords and tenants as to where to kind of structure things. So, you know, right now it's very judge case dependent. Is this adequate heat or not? So the idea is to kind of give a signal that 68 is what we're going to do, or late fees is going to be the amount, or security deposits. The idea is to kind of put some clarity out there, so it's not very, you know, am I doing okay or not? Well, I guess I'll find out when I get sued. As opposed to I'm doing okay right now because there's a statute saying this is what I'm supposed to do and I'm doing it.
Thank you. I want to enter for the record that Representative Clark did come, just was not able to make the presentation. Mr. Dahl, did you have something really quick?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I wanted to point out there are a couple of questions about Section 8 housing and inspectors, and it's important to know, and we'd be happy to talk to you later about this, there are different types of federal programs. There are vouchers and there are project-based. The case that came up before you and that we can provide other examples of are of a project-based federally subsidized building where the inspections are done randomly on a random unit, and so they don't always catch the problems that you'll see that other tenants have. For voucher-based programs, there's the annual inspection. So if you like to have more questions about that, we'd be happy to walk you through sort of where we see the difficulties in inspections not catching these problems.
I think Mr. Dahl would be happy to answer any questions if they contact him regarding that. We're over now 10 minutes, so... since we didn't formally present the bills, we don't have to formally lay them over. So the parties are going to go back and work on them, and I expect both parties to continue to work and come to reasonable conclusions on these. I think so far things are going very well this year on the negotiations, and I just want to make sure you both get the hint to continue
acting reasonably with each other. Thanks. With that, the meeting's adjourned.